joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Jason, WF2N, will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion, to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder in as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Jason WF2N will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they are free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now, I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Jason WF2N. Good evening, Jason.
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everyone listening. Hopefully you can hear me.
I can. There's a little bit of crunching in the background. I think it's this weather pattern we're having, but I can hear you right now. I hope it continues. I was having some strange little problems. Signal was degrading, and I had to switch radios in the middle of the last technical net, but so far, so good.
Very much, Roy.
Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We meet here every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 9 p.m., and we have a puzzle available, so if you want to check that out, it does require looking at an illustration. It's got a little bit of a trick to it, but I'm sure you guys can figure it out. But before that, let's ask if there's anyone with a technical question or any topics they'd like to discuss. If such is the case, please let me know by hitting that push-to-talk button and giving me your call sign and your first name. Okay, once again, in the fine tradition, we're going to have a quiet beginning. Sometimes people don't remember it's the fourth Wednesday in the month, and, you know, what can I tell you? Or they don't remember it's 9 o'clock, and so usually we get more activity as the hour progresses. I wish I had a canned spiel to give you guys that are listening. But I'll just kind of, once again, ask if anyone out there has any questions of a technical nature, any topics they would like to discuss tonight. If so, give me your call sign and your first name. I think I heard the repeater key up, but I didn't hear any audio, so if someone tried to get in, please, if you could rev up the engines a little hotter or point your antenna a little bit more in the direction of our repeater and give it another try.
NVB here.
Bob, I was worried about you. You're one of those guys that always shows up.
Yes, I'm here. Unfortunately, I just don't have any questions on my mind right now. I'll try to come up with something, but I just don't have anything. I was hoping somebody else would start the ball rolling. So I'll try to think of something. I'm back to net.
Very good, Bob. We'll give you some time to think something up. And once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am net control operator for this, the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m., and we go for as long as we need to go. We never kind of shut it down prematurely. If people continue to have questions, we try our best to give them advice on the subject. So once again, if anyone has any questions of a technical nature tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, once again, nothing much heard. I'll just give you my 2 cents worth on the coronavirus these days. Although, unfortunately, if you listen to any news agency, you probably hear way too much of it. Work is still progressing on vaccines. Work is still progressing on antivirals and different chemicals that are being utilized during the really bad phase of respiratory failure, steroids and such. And they seem to be having some beneficial effects. Vaccines are showing some promise. It's going to take time to figure out whether they're the magic bullet or not. Billions of dollars have been channeled into pharmaceutical companies to manufacture hundreds of millions of dosages of a vaccine once it's proven to be efficacious, and it's going to be pretty much given away free thanks to government subsidies. Thankfully, New York is very quiet and peaceful. The amount of cases are very low. Hospitalizations are very low. Death rate is very, very low. And that's all well, that's good. That's great. Unfortunately, in the states to the south of us, the southeast and the southwest, they're getting hit hard. It's been over last 2 days. Over 1,000 people have died each day of coronavirus-related illnesses, and the infection rate and case rate is going up. And it's probably going to go up for a little while longer until things that people do to limit the acceleration have an effect. There's a lag time that confuses, confounds, and frightens most people. The problem is that cause and effect is not immediate. It's stretched out for a good month. What you do today will have might have a great effect, but it will have a great effect in about 3-4 weeks. So anyway, that's my short rendition of the coronavirus, good, bad, and indifferent. And I as always, advise people not to be fearful, not to hide under the floorboards, but to behave reasonably, like reasonable adults. Don't take unnecessary risks. Use social distancing. Use masks when you are in public with other people, closer than 6 feet to each other or in enclosed areas. And kind of limit your risk as best you can. Anyway. I am, once again, AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If you have a question of a technical nature or any topics you would like to discuss, please give me your first name and your call sign.
2NVP, I could ask a couple virus-related questions.
Okay, very good, Bob. Ask away.
On the radio, I forget who this guy is, supposedly some doctor authority, I heard on radio today. There was some study done somewhere where it seems possible now that they found some evidence that even people that had no symptoms but had the virus at some point, no, they have the antibodies, had some, like, lung damage, as well as people who did have symptoms. And I think it's just one study. Have you heard anything about this?
Yes, Bob, I did. Unfortunately, it's not only that it kills people, but it does damage organ systems, and it can damage even young people's organ systems to one degree or another. It's a little bit more difficult to discern the damage, but they've seen a lot of scarring and such from people who have had the infection and resolved from it, and even people who weren't particularly symptomatic have demonstrated some changes on CAT scans and such. So, you know, this might unfortunately be a situation, you know, kind of like rheumatic heart disease, where if it doesn't immediately kill you, it might cause you problems as you get older. So, yeah, I have heard those things, and it concerns me a great deal.
Really alarming. Well, maybe it'll make some people take it more seriously, but at what a cost. The other thing is, I was just curious about hearing these things about people hacking and stealing, you know, proprietary information from people working on vaccines. And as a part of me saying, well, they should just share the knowledge and make it open source, but I don't know all the details. Whether that's probably not a good thing, maybe. Yeah, what's your thoughts on that?
I agree with you. I think they should share it. The problem is that, you know, these are pharmaceutical companies. You know, some of them are university-based, but others are pharmaceutical companies. They don't really have pipelines out as well as they might for this situation. One would hope as a discovery comes to fruition, they will share it with the rest of the world. The problem is that the Russians have a lot of computer hackers and a lot of free time, and they're messing around and trying to steal the information, I guess, before we give it to them. I'm sure they're a little paranoid, and they think that we'll either not give it to them or we'll kind of poison the well for them. So, again, we live in tribal, paranoid times, and I agree with you. I think knowledge should be shared. Again, pharmaceutical companies have not been great about sharing information.
My only fear is, given the way they are, if they thought their stuff was hacked and stolen, would they be less motivated to get the scoop, so to speak, on the virus? And I mean, it's weird, but they might not be so motivated to rush on it.
I think for the most part they're not that worried about making a profit, in that government agencies are just kind of sitting around with blank checks ready to write billions of dollars for them. So the first guy who can prove a effective, safe vaccine is in to make, you know, they're saying that they're not going to make any profit off of it. But again, I don't know. I don't know if I trust them exactly to not make a single dollar off of them. So I don't think this is going to slow down the pace or the rate of research. It's just an annoyance. You know, you have to stop in the middle of it to smack a gnat.
Just hear some stories. You know, it sounds like the stories make it sound like it is an alarming thing for us that this stuff's being stolen, and the story scratch my head, maybe it's not so much for us an alarming thing if stuff's being hacked.
Again, I mean, the Russian GRU has a building, I'm told, where these guys just kind of all sit around in desks and hack all day long. So this is what they do for a living. I guess in this time of pandemic, the most likely target is pharmaceutical and research labs, just to kind of watch what's happening, you know, over our shoulder, and if they can steal the stuff and speed things up. I mean, you know, basically this is kind of like a rerun of what they did with the atomic bomb all those many years ago.
That's a little different, I guess. You don't want them to have the bomb. It's alarming that they're hacking in general, but maybe this information being hacked isn't just... Anyway, I also heard that, we're in a second wave of the virus. I think that's more semantics. Some would call it the second wave. Some would say this is just the first wave continuing, blah, blah, blah. I guess that gets kind of semantic.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it gets you anywhere by first, second, or thirding this. Generally speaking, I conceive of this as part of the first wave. It didn't really die down. It was kind of bubbling to the surface in the south, and they got a little bit too risky and opened things up prematurely. They didn't go with the CDC guidelines. The CDC issued their guidelines, but a lot of the states involved said, it looks okay to us. And although the cases were flattened, they weren't, they didn't go down, they just went flat. And that's not good enough. You want it to go as far down as you can before you start opening things up. So I consider this southern involvement as a later portion of the first wave. The big problem is eventually, especially since we're opening up New York State more as time progresses, there's going to be a little splash over from the south, because people come and go no matter what you do and what you tell them to do. I'm expecting we're going to get, I don't know if that will be called the second wave. And then, of course, there's the flu season coming up, which is going to add a further complication that's yet to be determined, how badly the two viruses are going to, interact with the population.
I would call it a second wave, like if it came back here where it already had a big wave already, whereas those places that it's in now, waving up, if you get that terminology, it was like the first time for them. So anyway, I also heard that there's a virus, I don't suppose they're going to the next phase of the vaccine testing. I guess a couple of them are starting to, instead of testing a few hundred people or whatever, they're going to start testing tens of thousands of people or something very soon. Have you heard anything about that?
They do it in stages, stage one, stage two, stage three. I think this is now stage four. They've shown that it's relatively safe and it develops antibodies in a small group of people tested, and now they'll widen the testing pool. I don't know exactly what the criteria they're going to use, whether they're just going to do a random one or a low-risk group, more likely, people under the age of 50 and such, and volunteers, and they're doing that, I think, in the Oxford study as well. There's one study in the United States that's progressed that far, and the Oxford study has progressed about the same pace. So that's two of them. And like I said, there's probably 95 other vaccine studies being worked on throughout the world.
Actually, there's a program I listened to just before this and that. Dr. Michio Kaku, he brought that up. He was saying phase four and the few places are testing it, and it could be good, but also there's always that risk that we're being rushed and it could be side effects we don't know about till down the road, as I've heard you say too. But I guess that's some of the risks we're kind of forced to take. Back to you, Roy.
Well, it's a two-edged sword. It's not just bureaucrats who slow things down with regulations and testing. The testing finds things that early tests don't. I've mentioned before about thalidomide. Thalidomide was not that much of a problem, thankfully, in the United States, because we, even back then, we sort of dragged our feet, although there were cases of children being born without limbs. In England, there was a lot more of that going on, I'm told. So it's good to be cautious, but we're taking a bit of a gamble. If we're lucky, the vaccines that appear safe in relatively small samples, and I'm saying relatively small because there's a big difference between, say, testing 10,000 people and testing giving the vaccine to 300 million people. With the swine flu vaccine, there was a tendency to get Guillain-Barré and requiring a respirator and causing all kinds of problems. And we're not even quite sure what the hell that was all about after all this time. So it is possible that you could test something on 10,000 or even 100,000 people and not see anything go wrong, and then start giving it to 300 million people and find that you've killed 10,000 people out of those 3 million. And that would be a terrible thing. So we're taking a few chances, but I guess the sense is that the economy and the quality of life requires that. The history books will judge us one way or the other.
Basically what he said, he also used the thalidomide example, and it's just kind of like, we're forced one risk versus another risk. Okay, maybe someone has a radio question now.
Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this should be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. It's held every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 9 p.m. If you have a question of a technical nature, please give me your first name and your call sign.
Charlie 2, Zulu Victor William.
Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Echo, Joe in Gravesend, Brooklyn, New York. Roy, I don't have a question, just here supporting the net.
Thank you very much, Joe. William, welcome aboard. Any question tonight?
I think I need to get into HF, and I want to get a really good radio, so I'm looking, I want a recommendation for something that would be, that would work, maybe a multi-band radio that I could do 6 meters and 10 meters on, and has a waterfall display and stuff like that, and it looked really expensive, so I would hate to buy the wrong thing.
Well, I mean, you'll get different opinions from different people. People like different brands and different models and what have you. What you might want to take a look at, and it's a little bit too early for me to tell you whether it's worth it or not, but ICOM is coming up with a very nice all-in-one low-power radio, the ICOM 705. I've heard it that it's going to go anywhere from $1,000 to $1,300. It's all of HF. It's 2 meters and 70 centimeters. The only downside is it's very small, but it's very portable. You could run it on a battery. It puts out 5 watts on a battery. It puts out 10 watts if you plug it into a wall outlet. And I think the idea is they'll be coming out with amplifiers to plug into it so that you could get 100 watts or if you're interested in 1,000 watts, you know, down the road type of thing. That's one thing. Almost everyone I talk to who's bought an ICOM 7300, which is purely an HF, it doesn't do 2 meters, it doesn't do 70 centimeters, tends to love it. One guy doesn't particularly love it. It wasn't his cup of tea. He traded it in for a Yaesu 991A. Joe is an owner of a shiny new 991A, and that's a all-in-one type of a radio. It does HF and UHF VHF. So those are just a smattering. I mean, there are other radios that people like. I love my Flex radio, but some people don't like software-defined radios that are controlled mostly by computers, and I understand that. Other people love Elecraft. It's a high-quality radio with a premium price. But that's just a few. Let me ask if anyone out there wants to make a case for any particular model.
Alpha Charlie 2 Alpha Echo. Go ahead or not, but should I go?
Yes, Joe, please, go.
As Roy had mentioned, yes, I did recently get a 991 and Alpha, and I really, really enjoy the radio. I love that it's all band, all mode. That's a big plus for me. Having the 2-meter sideband back again is awesome. I love it, so... yeah, if you're into like 2-meter sideband and good stuff like that, you're definitely going to want to pick something up all band, all mode. And but that's really it. The 7300, man, I can tell you firsthand, I don't own the radio, but Matt, K2ACD, does. And that's a really nice radio, man. So that's something to consider as well, that that Roy was also mentioning. And what else, man? What else? I really don't know anything else that's out there really right now for radio. But I can tell you that the 991 is very affordable. So there's that as well. I got this one. It came to, I think, $1,300 with tax and all. It was on sale. It was $100 off. So something to look at. AC2, AE.
Basically what's going on different frequencies while you're on certain frequency?
Somebody was transmitting with you during that last transmission. All I heard was something with the frequencies.
Does this 991 radio have a waterfall display that shows what's going on in other frequencies while you're on a certain frequency?
Yes, it does, and you can control the width of it as well. I usually keep mine at 200K, so it's like 100 up and 100 down. I believe, I'm not 100% sure, I think you go up to 1,000. It's a pretty good one. I gotta say, though, the one on the ICOM 7300, I believe, in my opinion, is a better waterfall display. The only difference is it doesn't have the VHF, UHF in that particular radio. So, you know, you lose out over there. And also the Yaesu 991 has the C4FM. So, you know, and that 7300 is a little bit more expensive. But from what I understand, the quality of the radio is a little bit better. So I really don't know which one to, like, really suggest to you. I can tell you I'm more familiar with the 991, though. AC2AE.
AC2ZV. So, does the 991 do DMR as well as FM, as well as SSB? And all that together, I have to look into that.
Definitely won't do DMR. It'll do all the other modes. It'll do AM, FM, sideband, upper and lower. It'll do RIDI, it'll do packet, I believe that's about it.
So I'm looking at either trying to buy a DMR thing or try to go to HF. I think that HF is going to actually be better in the long run, and I'd like to talk about antennas. I heard a guy had a magnetic loop in the other room the other day. What's a good antenna for not very much space?
you just asked the ancient question. We got to get some of the sages in over here to give us some knowledge on that one.
Just check that I have this. Okay. William, it's kind of different, the DMR versus HF. DMR is basically UHF or VHF, or you can go through a hotspot so you don't need any RF. You can utilize a handy talkie for DMR. You can get a TYT-380 or a GD-77, less than $100. So that's one end of the spectrum. HF is sort of the other end of the spectrum where you're going to want a bigger, more expensive machine and definitely RF, and antennas for HF are different, although they're based on the same theories. You have to scale up the size and such. So if you want to talk about HF antennas, one of the people who has a magnetic loop is Bob, KD2NVB. They're very nice in that they're very small. They could be set up and broken down in many cases. They don't require elevation as much as most other antennas. The downside is that they have a very high Q with a very narrow bandwidth, and you have to keep retuning it if you change the frequency almost in any direction. And also, it has a limited amount of power because it utilizes a large capacitor in the tuning network, and because of the high Q, it has high voltage at the edges, and so you have to have an expensive capacitor that can take the voltage discharge. So most magnetic loops are going to operate under 100 watts. There are some that are beefier, but that's the downside with magnetic loops.
Can the magnetic loop be used outdoors, or is it only an indoors thing?
Hopefully, you should, you know, although Bob uses it indoors because that's all he could put it, it's always best to put your antennas outdoors. The beauty of an antenna, of a magnetic loop, though, is with things like horizontal antennas, you have to have it at least half of a wavelength above the ground, or else it just sends the signal straight up into the sky, and it doesn't skip on the ionosphere. So at best, it gives you near vertical incident sky waves for local communication, but no DX. The magnetic loop, though, can operate as little as 7-8 feet off the ground. It doesn't even pay to raise it beyond 10 feet off the ground. You don't have any additional benefit. But outside is much preferable to inside. Away from metallic objects is very good. And away from anything that kind of blocks it is a good idea.
Building over here that's about 100 feet long by about 20 feet wide. And it's got different levels and stuff. And I'm trying to figure out how to, do an antenna that would work in the building. And it seems like I would need to see if there's somebody that wants to come over and talk to me about it. Well, what do you think about that kind of thing?
Well, yeah, I mean, sometimes that's the case. You find someone who's mobile in these times of pandemic to kind of scope out your environment and give you some suggestions. I'm sure someone in the club would be more than happy to do that. There's a laundry list of different types of antennas available. It depends upon how much space you got, how much elevation you can have, how simple to set up you want it to be, how cheap you want it to be, and how much power you want it to throw. So there's a whole bunch of things. You have to decide on what band you're interested in, what power rating you're interested in, and what limitations the area for that radiator has to obey.
How much power can that 991, I have to look into it further, but how much power can that 991 put out? And then I'd need a multiband antenna to use it with, kind of thing.
It can put out 100 watts, so you have to keep that in mind. There are some magnetic loops that will be able to drive 100 watts, and there are others that you'd probably want to be a little bit more cautious with.
Well, it seems like the thing to do is to look into both radios a little bit further and think about some kind of antenna system that would work. Is there such a thing as a line amplifier that you put at the antenna away from the radio because you have a long transmission line, or do you just take the line loss?
You basically take the line loss. There are antenna tuners that are placed at the feed point for an antenna. So to limit the line loss from reflected signals from a VISWA that's uncorrected until it hits your antenna tuner. So for that, there are external devices. As far as linear amplifiers, they're too big and too difficult to deal with to just have them sit on the outside of your house. You can, though, use less lossy transmission line if you're so inclined. Coaxial cable is very good in that it's shielded and you don't have to worry about things getting near to it. But in the good old days, they had open line for all the transmission lines. They have very little attenuation loss over a given distance. So you might want to consider using an open wire a ladder line or twin lead or something like that as your transmission line.
I think there's two parts to it. First, you got to get out of the house, and then you got to get up to the antenna. So it may be that you would do something, maybe an LMR 400 or something, to get out to some kind of transformer to launch the ladder line or something, but it doesn't make sense to bring the ladder line in the house. But I don't know. I have to look at the antenna to decide.
I would agree. I mean, you know, base it upon other factors. I'm just giving you something to think about. LMR 400 is very good coaxial cable. I use it myself, but it does have attenuation loss. And if you are feeding a non-resonant radiator that is where the impedance needs to be matched at your shack, you have to understand that the impedance is not transformed until it gets to your antenna tuner in your shack. So there's a lot of reflected signals that are being attenuated as they bounce back and forth. That's why some people get weather-sealed external antenna tuners so that they could tune their antenna to be as close to 1-to-1, you know, 50 ohm impedance as possible.
Okay, so I should plan that there should be an external antenna tuner and you know, between the transmitter and the radio, as well as some kind of ground block, and then some kind of multiband antenna that would somehow work in conjunction with all the bands on the radio.
The problem is that it's very hard to come up with a multiband antenna that's perfectly resonant and giving you the 50 ohms that you want. So you need some method of correcting. The most lossless method is correcting via an impedance matching circuit at the antenna feed point and operating it remotely. I don't do that because it's inconvenient. You know, I'd have to mount it up on the roof and it's difficult to get to and such. And so I do that manipulation down at my shack and eat the losses. So you have to think again in terms of what antenna. If you choose something like a magnetic loop, although it has a high Q and a very narrow bandwidth, it's tuned internally in the device. There are manual tuners, and there are electronic servo control tuners. For those situations, you do not need a separate antenna tuner either locally at the feed point or remotely. The tuning network built into a given magnetic loop will suffice.
What it really sounds like to me is I need some form of switch at the end of this coax on the roof that I can choose different antennas from, you know, because there's so many different options out there.
I mean, there's different ways of handling that as well. If you wanted to, you could have one coax going from your shack to an array of antennas and an external weatherproofed antenna switch that could be actuated from the roof. What I simply do is I just run multiple portions of LMR 400. One of them feeds each of my antennas, so I don't have to deal with another possible failure point. It all comes into my shack, and I do the switching internally.
How many lines did you run? Like seven lines when you went up to the roof?
I have, let me count up. I have my Serio 10-meter, my antenna fan dipole, and my GP6. So I have three coaxial cables coming in from the roof. I have a GP3 that's hooked onto my laundry pole, and I have an old magnetic loop receiver that had a high-gain amplifier circuit switched in, which blew out a long time ago. So that's a total of five different coaxial cables that feed into the window of my of the back room of my first-floor house.
I guess typically you have each of those hooked up to a different radio then.
Necessarily. Some are hooked up to different radios. Some are hooked up to different antenna ports on the same radio. It sort of depends. My HF radio can take more than one HF antenna. So I have, it goes through a circuitous route. I have two antenna tuners, and I also use diversity reception. So I can listen in one ear on my vertical and the other on my horizontal. So it's a little bit complicated in the back of my boxes, but ultimately it's possible to hook more than one antenna up to one radio.
The actual radio has diversity receivers, and you can see the signal strength of the H versus the V input?
Yes.
Like a standard feature in this ICOM 7300 or the 919, do you think?
No, we're talking esoteric here. That's my Flex Radio 6700. It has two discrete receivers, and you can run them simultaneously and manipulate the signal. I do not think 991As have that. I don't even think, unfortunately, 7300s have that. It's a rarity in amateur radios, as far as I'm aware. There might be a few others out there that I'm not aware of, but I don't think the 991A or the 7300 can quite do that yet.
Pretty cool trick. I suppose it would be two radios and a little switch at the headphones otherwise.
I mean, you could jerry-rig something like that, and people have, and they certainly did in the old days. I mean, it's a fascinating ability to do that, in that every so often when 10 meters opens up to Florida, I will hear Faraday rotation. I will hear the signal on my right ear where it's horizontally polarized, and then it will fade, but then grow into my other ear where it's vertically polarized. So I can actually see the polarization angle of the radio wave rotate as I listen to the transmission. It's fun.
Reading up on this ionospheric transmission, and from the book I was reading, it's telling me that all reflections are circularly polarized, and your H or your V antenna will pick them up differently. But really, if you have a left and a right circular polarized antenna, you're better off, and then you can actually pick up actually 3 dBs over an H or a V antenna. So I was thinking about what something like that would be, a CPHF antenna.
Good luck with that. Most amateur antennas that I'm aware of tend to be linearly polarized. I mean, You know that electromagnetic waves are linear equations, and so you can define a circularly polarized wave as the sum of two waves at right angles to each other, and vice versa. So six of one, half a dozen of the other. I don't know if there's really the 3 decibel gain from that or not. I would have to review it more, but it would be a big pain in the backside to come up with something that would be capable with good efficiency of giving you both a clockwise and counterclockwise circular polarization. And I don't know exactly how you would merge them together under those circumstances.
The idea is they don't get merged together. You actually need to have two additional runs of coax, one for the left and then one for the right, you know, circular. Apparently, then, if you have the two CP antennas, you actually can, you know, then check the difference between all your different antennas. So the more I'm seeing, it just seems like it would be so much fun to design a system that you could be able to do more experimenting with, rather than just put up one antenna and then that's all you get.
For the most part, that's what people do. They experiment. In the old days, they experimented with everything. Nowadays, with a very esoteric circuitry and surface mount devices, most people are not building or modifying their their radios or even their antenna tuners for the most part. Most of the experimentation is on the antenna front. And there are people who play with antennas all the time. I know of some people that are always telling me about their latest, greatest antenna project. You know, sometimes it's real esoteric, and they're bending a flexible aluminum tubing, but other people just go to Home Depot and buy some cheap insulated wire and run it in different configurations. So the only thing that limits you is where you can put these things, but there are an almost infinite number of design. I mentioned more than a few times that I particularly like the ARRL antenna handbook. It has a lot of designs that it discusses.
You need to have a ground point near the end of the coax so that you should have a good conductor to ground, even though if it's on the roof, at the point, you know, where you actually connecting to the antenna.
It depends upon whether you're having a balanced or an unbalanced antenna. If you have a balanced antenna, something like a dipole, you don't have to be that concerned about a ground, and there are people who float their grounds. Even in unbalanced antennas, many people will float their grounds. Grounding is good for static electricity protection and lightning protection, but it's not 100% necessary. It's a good safety measure, but there are some people who just can't pull it off because they're working in an apartment house where they're on the 10th or the 15th floor, and by the time it gets down to ground potential, the impedance of the wire that they're planning to use is just so high that it's of little value. So it sort of depends upon the antenna system, your risk factors, your location, and what you could do under the circumstances.
It sounds like it'd be good to plan on some gas tube spark arrestors, you know, someplace like mid-path or something like that on the coax run. What about a lightning rod?
I don't know of anyone who actually uses a lightning rod per se. I mean, they use something that probably is very similar, little spikes that hopefully, and they wire those to ground and hope that the lightning chooses that line rather than the nearby antenna with a transmission line going into your shack. Gas discharge devices are good. I've used them. I hook them up to my ground. You keep them outside of the shack, obviously. The idea is it's another belt and suspenders move that hopefully if you get a high enough electrical potential, it'll jump through the gas tube and go straight to ground rather than wreak havoc with your equipment. You have to, though, maintain those things because after a few discharges, they don't work as well as they once did. But as long as you keep that in mind, it's a nice belt and suspenders type of move.
You have to have a good ground where you set them so that, you know, the spark actually goes someplace besides the radio.
It necessitates having a good ground. If you're going to float your ground, those devices don't really give you any benefit at all.
No, I think you would float it when you got up to the roof, when you went through the Valen, and then you would play games from there, but... these are all great considerations. Thanks a lot. I don't know if anybody else has any questions for the TechNet, but Roy, I'm going to give it back to you for now unless somebody's got some more advice.
Very good, William. Anyone out there who's been listening in who would like to offer their 2 cents worth there?
NVB.
And I missed your call sign.
This is Bob, KD2NVB.
Bob.
Way back, I'd just like to mention another all-in-one radio that you, Roy, and I both have. You could consider this too. It's also even more of a budget. The ICOM 7100 all-in-one radio. It does, you know, it does D-Star, of course, and it does the higher bands, and it does HF, and it'll do single sideband on 2 meters and things like that. it's got a very similar interface to the 7300. It doesn't have all the, it doesn't have the scope really. It has a very crude kind of, what do you call it? You know, when you can just hit the button, it'll give you this sort of grayscale image of the, of what the band looks like. But it's, you can probably, last I looked, you could probably have it for under $800. And it's got a lot of nice features. It's got this small little head that I like for my space. And you put a long cord on and you can pull it into the next room or something. So I just wanted to throw that out. Also, I had a question about the 705 with the amplifiers. Back to you, Roy.
Very good. I just want to add to what Bob said. I'm using an IC7100 right now. It's not the latest and the greatest. It doesn't have the pan adapter waterfall that I think William is sort of looking for. I have that on my Flex 6700, but the 7100 kind of came out about 8-9 years ago, I think, and it's really a legacy analog radio. The Flex and the 7300 are really software-defined radios. I think the 991A is still pretty much a analog radio with IF stages and such. But the 7100 is a nice radio. It's black and white, though. Some people like it prettier in color, and it doesn't give you a nice waterfall.
KD2NVB, if this subject's exhausted for the moment, I was going to ask about amplifiers on the 705 that you briefly mentioned.
I just want to know, William, if you have any other questions or if anyone out there has any opinions that they'd like to share, advice that they'd like to give William.
William, Roy, I think you should talk about the amps on the 705s. Back to you, Roy.
Very good. So, Bob, what did you want to ask about the 705 and any future linear amplifiers that could be plugged into it?
You just mentioned that you heard that you thought there were plans for amps, and I heard before that no one knew that, but I was hoping, because what I'm hoping for is I don't really want a radio that's ultimately limited to 10 watts with an external battery. But if that radio came out and there was an option for like a small lightweight amp that would maybe get you to 40, 50 watts in the field, that could really interest me. I was wondering if is any more details known about what amps might be available for it?
Fortunately, no. It has been, to my knowledge, released in Japan. So they're buying and using them locally. It was supposed to be released to the United Kingdom this month, but it still seems to not be shipped yet. And your guess is as good as mine as when it will be available in the United States. ICOM is sort of blaming the FCC, and their testing facilities are slowing down the process, they say. And they're hopeful that they might get FCC approval and start shipping them in September. But details are few and far between. They're not even publishing the English version of the manual, operating manual for it. So it sort of depends upon how much ICOM thinks that they could make with a plug-in amplifier. I mean, there are other companies that do make high-gain amplifiers that will take a 10-watt signal, but I could understand why you'd like something that's just meant to be plugged in and not have to worry about it. And also, that would be an interesting point. I don't know exactly how much of an amplifier they would be looking at and whether it would be something amenable to battery power or something that would require a much more hefty power supply.
It'd be great if they had both options. I could see someone just buying that radio, because it looks like it's going to cost about as much as a 7300, possibly more, because I think you can now get a 7300 for just $1,000 or so. I could see someone buying that and having some 100-watt amp or more at home, and then some lightweight amp to go out in the field that would only weigh a pound or, you know, whatever, so it'd still be lighter than carrying like a 7100 out in the field. And you know, go out with the battery in it, whatever. So, yeah, that's what I was thinking about. Okay, back to net.
From your lips to ICOM's brain, what can I tell you? Marketing departments are curious creatures, so we'll see what they have in store. I'm somewhat optimistic. I've heard a lot of great things about the 7300, and what little I've been able to glean about the 705 makes me think that this is going to be a memorable radio, but, you know, only time will tell.
I saw on YouTube by this guy that I've watched this guy a lot when I was checking out my, he's the guy maybe decided to buy a chameleon loop. He's called Survival Tech Nord, and he's, I forgot his call sign off the top of my head, it's OH8 something. And he did a review of it, and he's totally into QRP and being out in the field. And he thought the ICOM was, looked like it was great. Of course, he hasn't seen one yet himself, but he's got all the information. He thought it'd be like a lot easier to hook up to do digital or anything, like probably a lot easier to set up than like a KX3 or those things. It was kind of all, I guess, kind of like the way the 7300 is, where you can hook it up to digital or all these things very conveniently, a lot less cabling, et cetera, et cetera. So, back to that.
Like I said, there's a lot of anticipation. There's a lot of people holding their breath and hoping for the best. I'm sure there are people who put their money down to be the first in line when it ships. Hopefully it's not going to be a replay of ICOM 706. The 706 was probably one of the biggest popular radios in the late 1990s, early 21st century, except that the original model wasn't quite up to snuff. And so if you ask a lot of semi-old-timers what kind of radio they have from the old times, it's not uncommon for them to say that they have a 706 Mark II. Not a 706, but a 706 Mark II. So hopefully they won't need to issue a Mark II on the 705. But again, heard a lot of great things. It's basically a software-defined radio, which is, I think, the future of radio technology. And it looks like it might be a very useful toy.
I think Howard and 2GOT has a 706, maybe likely a Mark II. I just know that when I did field day last year, I used his radio, and I think it was a 706. It's a very nice little radio. Had fun with it. Back to Ned.
It's strange in that I've noticed that there are kind of landmark radio models that define certain time periods where it seems like guys who bought a radio at that time, at least half of them bought this model. And again, in the late 1990s, early 21st century, it was the 706 Mark II. Then by about 28, 29, it became the Kenwood TS-2000 that every other person had. I knew a guy in Staten Island that owned five TS-2000s. And in the same vein, lately the ICOM 7300 has sort of been that the go-to radio. I mean, when 10 meters opens up and I ask people what they're using, 50% of the time they tell me a 7300. So it sounds like this is our age's best price point right now.
I could get a decent HF setup to make it worth my while. I mean, I might just keep using the 71 for a while, but I might be tempted to get a 7300, but I can't justify it now because I need an antenna. I mean, you know, a place to put an antenna. Back to net.
I understand. I bought my 7100 before I had a great antenna system. I was able to kind of rationalize that to myself. I wouldn't even begin to buy my Flex radio if I didn't have a decent antenna system. So yeah, you gotta learn to crawl before you walk and learn to walk before you run.
B2 Zulu Victor.
William.
Hi, I'm looking at these two radios, the 991A and the 7300, and I wonder if either one of them has a computer interface so that you can actually have a larger display, because they seem like they're very small displays?
That's a good question. To a degree, yes, but I don't know if it's as nice as you would like it to be. I'm not exactly aware if the Yaesu 991A has software that goes with the radio to give you a graphic display on a computer screen. I know that the ICOM does. It's RSBA1 version 2. So it is able to take some of the data via the USB port and translate it. You would have to kind of look up some articles that show you what the screen captures look like to see whether or not that suited you. It's not sort of like, again, my Flex does everything on my computer screen, so it's all there. And I can put it up on an iPad, and I can put it up on a tablet, and, you know, whatever. But with these things, it's not quite as flashy. So Joe can advise me if 991A has any software that lets you visualize the pan adapter on a computer screen.
Alpha Charlie 2 Alpha Echo. They don't have specifically for the radio, but there is secondary software. It's called Windows Yaesu Suite. And it's really good. You could actually see your parametric EQ. You could actually see the waterfall. You have complete control of the radio. Also, the menu settings. So it's pretty good to have it as well. That's about it, all it's got for software purposes. Then they've got the programming software for it as well. So. I've been playing around and using that the last few days. AC2AE.
Thanks a lot, Joe.
Joe, so there's a USB port on the 991A and you hook that to the radio and run the software like that, or you plug in the analog I.O.?
Do either or. It has an RS-232 port that you can plug into your computer, or it has a USB port, which I'm currently using. And it comes with drivers, so you can download the drivers from Yaesu, and it loads them on your computer. So if you want to run any kind of like RIDI or FT8 or any kind of digital modes, you don't have to run any additional cables.
AC2ZV. Joe, can you run like the WinLink software as well through the interface without any additional cables?
I'm not sure about the WinLink, but I did use the just this past weekend for a very short time. I used that, JTS or whatever for the FT8. I was playing with that for a little bit. It was super duper easy. I mean, all I had to do was just change some settings to the audio settings for the mic and the headphones, and it was up and running in minutes.
I have an old laptop that's running Windows 10. It seems a little slow. Probably if I do all this, I'd probably have to get an upgrade. I don't know.
If the computer's running slow, it probably just needs to probably be cleaned out, and that's about it. You know, maybe a little bit of a memory upgrade, but you shouldn't have any problems getting this hooked up to a computer. Matter of fact, the USB cable is like the old printer cables. Mine just happened to have two ferrite beads on it, but I just snapped a couple more on there today because I read that those ferrite beads really aren't the best ferrites to have on it. So I just snapped two more ferrites onto the cable. So I figure, you know, the more the merrier. AC2, AE.
You got a lot to think about now. Sounds like I'm up to over $2,000 or $3,000. I'll have to see if I can really afford that or not, but I'd sure like to put something in.
from what I've been hearing tonight, I think your major problem is going to be an antenna. The radio is going to be the least of your problems, picking a radio. In all honesty, when it comes down to it, it's either going to be either Yaesu or ICOM. Those are two of the competing brands out there right now. I mean, I know you, Kenwood's got some radios out there, but I don't know. I think you're probably, you got a tough decision, man. Just choose a good antenna, something that you could put up. Hopefully, maybe you could ask your landlord if you could get something up on the roof, possibly. AC2AE.
Hey, Joe, I am the landlord over here.
Wait a minute, so then put something on the roof, man. Are you kidding me? Definitely, man. Get something on the roof.
Figure out the right thing. I think what I need is to plan a like a multi-cable run, maybe five or six cables to come from where I make a ham shack inside up to someplace outside, and then use that as the distribution point. So anyway, I'm looking at where I can punch a hole in the roof.
I don't know if I would punch a hole in the roof. I don't know how many antennas you're planning on putting up. Five or six. That's a lot. I've got four. I've got four antennas up there. Well, I've got three really high up there, and I've got one right off the balcony over here. So, yeah. All right. I mean, if I could help you with any advice or anything like that, let me know.
Joe, you know, earlier I was going to take you up on the field trip to come out and check out your place, but with the COVID thing, you know, that's put on hold indefinitely.
Yeah, I've been socially distancing. You know, I'm not a real big fan of wearing the mask, but I've always social distanced myself, so I've always stayed pretty far away from people. I'm not one of those people for hugging people and stuff like that. You know, a handshake is more than enough for me. I'm a big, huge fan of that fist bump, so we don't actually have to shake hands, you know. So, I was always into that, so this is just something normal for me now.
My kids have got the foot tap thing going, too.
I wish they would bring back the head nod, like nod the head, like, okay.
So listen, let's give it back to Roy and see if he can stump us with the tech net. Okay, Roy?
Very good, William. By the way, I would suggest not punching holes in your roof, because you're going to end up with water damage. You know, you could run the coax to the side of the wall and either feed it through under a slit of the window, or you can build an insert for the bottom of the window, or at worst comes to worst, punch a little hole in a wall and weatherproof it. But I wouldn't punch any holes in the roof if you can help it. Also, you'll find that most modern radios have USB connections that feed audio signals and the command lines to remotely control them. So that shouldn't be really that much of a problem. If you do utilize displays on your computer, it's really dependent upon the graphic accelerator in the computer that you use. If you don't have a good accelerator, it can really slow things down. So keep those things in mind.
Roy, I think there's a roof vent that's about a foot and a half long, has a one-inch slit on either side, and that looks like a perfect entry point to slide some cables through there. So I think that's what my target's going to be for the roof penetration.
William, just make sure that it's weatherproofed in some degree. You don't want, you know, the cable jackets can act as a good path for water draining down into them. So just be cautious.
Have to put a drip loop on the outside for sure, but that looks like the best candidate without any penetration. So I have to work out a lot of details with my to my wife about how actually I'm going to do this, so that's going to be the hard part.
It's always the hard part, but, you know, if you have any questions, I'm sure Joe would be willing to help you. I certainly would be willing to help you. Bob, you know, anyone, everyone in the club, that's one of the things we do for each other. So you know where to find us all.
Yeah, well, I'm going to put a budget together and see what that looks like and go from there. And it'll probably take me 6 months to finish this. So thanks a lot for all your advice.
William, this again is AC2GS, and this is the Kings County Radio Club's technical net that meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month at 9 p.m. Let's jump to the TechNet puzzle. It's again posted on the club's website. You just type in puzzle.kc2rc.com, and it will come up at the top of the page. It's an illustration, basically, with a transformer that the primary is 240 volts, the secondary is 12 volts. It feeds into a full-wave rectifier bridge across a smoothing capacitor, and then there's a little symbol of a voltmeter testing. And the question is, the figure above shows a low-voltage power supply. The transformer has a 12-volt secondary winding. To which range would the meter be switched? In other words, the voltmeter, what would you switch it to? And they give you four choices. The first, A, is 12 volts AC. The second is 12 volts DC. The third is 20 volts AC. And D, the fourth, is 20 volts DC. So that's the question for tonight. Anyone want to play?
Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Echo.
Sure. I can take a guess if no one else wants to answer it.
Kilo Delta 2, Sierra X-ray Delta.
Three people want. I don't know who to pick. I think Joe is first. Joe, you want to go?
I'm only going by my particular meter that I have over here. It doesn't have a specific 12-volt setting. It actually has a 5-volt setting, a 9-volt setting, and a 20-volt setting. So I'm going to say to measure 12 volts, we're going to go with 20 volts DC, 20 volts DC, direct current, which would be D.
Joe, but then that begs the question, in this particular question, the person has a voltmeter capable of all four of those settings. So if you did have a 12-volt DC setting on your voltmeter, would you prefer that, or would you still stick with the 20-volt DC setting?
If it was that, then my choice would definitely go to B, and that would be 12-volt DC. If those were my only choices, yeah, that would definitely go to 12-volt DC for me. Thank you, Roy, for clearing that up.
Very good, Joe. The next person who checked in was Bob, KD2NBB. You want to give us what you think is the right answer?
I'm going to say the same thing. I was going to say B, 12-volt DC. The fact that you're still asking, maybe it means it's wrong, but that's what I was going to say. Back to net.
Thanks a lot, Bob. There was a third person. I didn't get the entire call sign. So the third person who checked in when I asked if someone wanted to play, would you like to tell me what you think the best answer is?
Well, I'll take a stab at it. This is Kilo Delta 2, Sierra X-ray Delta, KD2SXD. Name here is Mike. First time on the net, been listening in on you guys. I was waiting for the new round of check-ins, but didn't hear that. So said, let me check in now for the puzzle. And I'm going to go with letter D, 20-volt DC. I don't know if my reasoning is correct, but if your power is over 12 volts, you want to make sure, I don't know. I'm just going to go with D. Final answer. Back to you, Net Control.
Very good, Mike. Yeah, we usually don't just take check-ins. I developed this technical net after Dick, K2RIW's, Limar TechNet, and he didn't take check-ins per se. It just, if anyone had any comments or questions or topics, It was open, but we didn't just check people in for the sake of checking in. But I'm glad you're listening, and I'm glad you're participating. And it's a little bit of a trick question. You have to sort of know a couple things about when they say 240 volts AC goes to 12 volts AC, they're talking about root mean square averaging. So you have to keep in mind to a degree that you have to keep in mind that there are peak voltages that are higher than root mean square. And the way to calculate the difference between a root mean square and peak is you multiply by the square root of 2, which is approximately 1.4. So even though the full bridge rectifier is going to have some voltage loss and the capacitor is going to be smoothing most of the ripples out, as you mentioned, you probably want to go above the 12 volts, and 20 volts is about as much peak power if your power supply wasn't properly smoothing things out. You don't want to find out that your power supply was broken and break your voltmeter in that. So the answer is D, 20 volts DC.
Charlie 2, Zulu Victor.
Yeah.
I kind of disagree because I think we should do the math and figure out what voltage we're going to read before we decide what setting.
Okay, I'm just saying that this is a brand new power supply that you cobble together, and you're not quite sure if the components are working yet. And would you try it on a 12 volt setting and hope that the filter capacitor was working and such, or would you kind of want a little insurance?
240 volts first to make sure I didn't have a short.
That goes without saying. We're assuming that the transformer itself is fine and dandy.
My point here is that if you take like the 12 volts RMS and you multiply that by 1.4, what do you get, like 16, 17 volts?
I think it comes up to something like 19 and change.
19 and change. And then you take that through a full wave bridge rectifier, then you get these pulses of half of 19, which is going to be around 10.
It's a full wave bridge rectifier. It rectifies both halves of the wave. So you're not going to have, if it was a half wave rectifier, you'd have half the voltage.
Puts them twice as fast. They're still not going to go beyond the peak half voltage swing. So, I mean, if you get a peak-to-peak voltage, like 20 volts, let's say, to make it easy, the 0 to plus and the 0 to minus, which both come through the full ways bridge rectifier is humpty-hump, basically don't go over 10 volts peak each, and then they hit the capacitor, and they're leveled out to, a little less than 10, so the 12 setting would be right.
Okay, but I'm just saying that it's probably best to be cautious and set the voltage at the highest that it could possibly be. If for some reason the electrolytic capacitor is doing a really bad job of smoothing, you're going to get the higher ripples than that, and you're going to get both ends of the voltage potential. You're not referencing it for the midpoint. It's not like it's the transformer is tapped in the middle, so it's going to be fluctuating between the full 12 volts one way and 12 volts the other way and 12 volts one way before it gets rectified, and so even if root mean square and fully smooth, if you don't consider, unfortunately, the voltage drop of the bridge rectifier, you'll end up with at least 12 volts.
I think you're going to end up with less than 12 volts. I kind of looked this up before, and so I was wondering, how this would go. But from what I found out was that you take the 12 volts, which is RMS, and then you get the peak-to-peak voltage, which you said recently was like 19 volts. But then the full wave bridge rectifier basically takes each half, and for the positive cycle, it goes through one pair of diodes, and negative, it goes through the other pair, but it's only going between zero and half of the peak voltage. And so then what happens is it's the half of the peak-to-peak voltage. And so it's like 0 to 10. And then you have a 7/10 of a volt drop for the diodes, and then you're, you know, about 9 point something. So I just was wondering, what the real math would be and what the final answer the meter would read.
I will look it up some more, but I can distinctly, in my mind's eye, a full-wave bridge rectifier is just going to have, like, you're flipping the bottom part of the sine wave up to the other side, and it's reading the peaks are above the 12-volt level. I'm not quite sure why you think that when you put full-wave rectifier bridge, it only gives you half the peak voltage. I'm not quite sure about that. I'll triple check, but I kind of swear that, except again for the voltage loss in the diodes themselves, you're going to get the same peak voltage level that the transformer had before the smoothing filter.
Yeah, but first of all, coming out of the transformer, we would definitely need the higher setting, because we would actually be reading the AC 12 volts coming in. So there'd be AC 12 volts RMS coming in, and the meter would read that as 12, but if we were to take the meter and reverse that RMS, we would multiply that 12 by 1.4, and so the peak-to-peak voltage, if we had an oscilloscope, would be something like that 19 volts would be going into that full-wave bridge rectifier. That would be peak-to-peak with a zero crossing, right?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at. It'll be about 19 volts peak-to-peak, and you don't quite, at this point, you don't know whether you put enough smoothing capacitance in, so that's probably why it would not be well advised to use a 12-volt DC meter setting. You kind of would pin the needle.
I'm not really so much worried about the meter. I'm just trying to get to the math. And so I think that if you take that 19-volt peak-to-peak signal and you put it through the full-wave bridge rectifier, instead of getting just a one little hump every other, during only the positive half, you get a hump on the positive half and the hump on the negative half. And so because of that, you're getting half of the peak-to-peak voltage coming up as the zero-to-peak voltage that hits the capacitor. So the most the capacitor would see would be half of the 19 volts between ground, or one side, and the output side of the diodes.
Again, the way that I thought of this is that the full bridge rectifier is basically, you're not getting a positive and a negative potential. You're getting the sine wave, the negative, say, going sine wave flipped positive, the positive staying positive, and that's the waveform that's now getting smoothed and getting red on the voltmeter. So I'm kind of lost here. If you were to place a half-wave rectifier, then I agree with you. You would only get a half the amount of power coming out. But with a full wave, I would think that you would get the entire peak-to-peak before you hit the capacitor.
I don't think it's really like that, because with a half-wave rectifier, you get like one peak, and then you wait, for it to go through the other cycle, then you get another peak, so you get a peak, wait, peak, wait, peak, wait, But with a full wave bridge, you get a peak, and then you can get it from the other side, and you get a peak, 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 peak. But it's only half of the peak-to-peak voltage in either case, but the difference is when it gets to the capacitor, there's not so much decay. So with a half wave, you're going to have much more decay than you get with a full wave, because it keeps being reinforced with the peak, peak, rather than the peak, wait, peak. Get it?
What happens when you have a half wave is the capacitor has to kind of fill more area during the pause, and so you can kind of say that the total power is sort of the area under the AV curve or some such. I will go back into the literature and check on this, and hopefully we'll chat again about this for the next technical net.
I'll send you an email of what I found. How can I send it to you, Roy?
Just send it to Roy at ac2gs.com. You could use anything with the domain ac2gs.com, and I'll get it.
KD2NVB with a comment.
Yes, Bob.
It doesn't really make a big difference with your overall argument, but I think the peak-to-peak is not 19, it's 16.8, because isn't it 12 times 1.4 back to net?
Okay, it's the square root of 2, so that's 1.414459, et cetera, et cetera. So, okay, the point being that it's above, that you might have a signal that's above 12 volts DC. So that's the primary reason for kicking the meter up to a higher point.
Like I said, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really make a big difference. I just had to point that out. Back to Ned.
Very good. Any other questions or comments for the technical net tonight? I am AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be August 5th, which will be held by teleconferencing. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Our regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater, KC2RC. If you can communicate using Fusion Digital Technology, please join in. You can connect to our repeater while in Fusion Digital mode, either directly using Fusion Digital Technology radios or by using a hotspot and some other digital technology using our network gateway, such as our XLX server. We offer an audio stream of the Fusion Net on the Internet, as well as all audio transmissions on our club repeater. That's located at stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is available on our club website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, 3 Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens, so try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. Well, we're rolling this up and shutting it down for now, but we will be back again August 12th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to everyone that participated tonight, especially Jason, WF2N. Without you guys, I would just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, and I'll be going clear and getting the heck out of here. Be safe, guys.
Roy, 73 to all. This is WF2N.
Hey, Roy, 73 to you. Thank you so much for the net tonight. William, Alpha Charlie Zulu 2, Zulu Victor, off.
Next week, Monday. So don't know when I'll be back to New York City. But I really enjoyed it, and thank you for the warm wishes on the repeater as well. KD2SXT, Mike, from Jacksonville, Florida, by way of the Bronx, 73.
Roy, KD2MVP, Bob, going clear.